Good morning, and we'll call the meeting to order. This is State Government Finance Committee meeting for February 1st, 2011. Happy February, everybody. And we do have a quorum, and so would someone move our minutes from the previous meeting?
Mr. Chair, I move to approve the minutes.
Representative Benson moves the minutes. Any additions or corrections to the minutes from January 27th? Hearing none, all in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. The minutes are approved. Well, today is Revenue Day, and we want to welcome back particularly Commissioner Salamone and his crew to lead us through an overview of the Department of Revenue. And Commissioner, it's a pleasure to have you back. I remember very well your days before as Commissioner before our Tax Committee, so we welcome you now before State Government Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to come here and answer your questions about the Department of Revenue, provide an overview of what we do, and look forward to your questions and as we move forward. With me is Dan Ostick, who is the Director of our Financial Management Division at the Department of Revenue. We provided some slides, and I thought the best way to proceed would be to sort of walk through those and take questions as we go along, and I think we'll be able to finish the presentation in a timely way. I know you have other things on the agenda.
Well, Commissioner, that's the way we like to do it. The committee has lots of questions, and it's best to get them as you go through the presentation rather than waiting.
Chair, I understand that I know there are many new members here, so it's an opportunity to get everyone on the same page, so to speak, and have a good understanding of what we do and why we do it. Of course, the why is pretty obvious. The mission of the Department of Revenue, and I'll start with the first slide, is to make the revenue system work well for Minnesota. And it may seem like a vague statement, but I can tell you that that short statement was birthed over many, many days of retreat and to sort of come up with a summary of what we are all about. We want to make the revenue system work for the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Taxes are generally not a pleasant thing for most of the taxpayers. We try to make it as easy as possible for people to understand, and we also are careful to make sure that our taxpayers are treated fairly and equitably. Our vision is that everyone pays the right amount of tax, no more or no less. So, yes, if we do find that a taxpayer has overpaid taxes, we are more than willing and very anxious to sort of make that right. On the next slide, we provided, and I'm sorry, it looks like it's a little hard to read, certainly from the monitor and from even my copy. There is an organizational chart. If you happen to have some magnifying glasses, you might be able to read it. I am the acting commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and I'm also serving in the capacity as deputy commissioner for the period of time during which Commissioner Myron Franz is in a sort of waiting to sort of get through his appointment date of, I think, April 21st. So the chart, the blue squares in the chart indicate executive or appointed positions. The orange or pinkish boxes are indicating usually directors of divisions of the department. So you can see how we're structured. We have four silos of assisting commissioners, one in charge of business taxes, the other in charge of individual taxes. And we have our chief information officer and our assistant commissioner for tax policy, whom you all know as Matt Mossman. We're delighted to have him back at the Department of Revenue. Below the silos, you can see the various divisions that report up to those leaders. We talk often in the department about our compliance cycle. When we talk about compliance, it's a holistic view of how we treat our taxpayers. And it's not just about going after taxpayers who are not compliant, and it's not just auditing and collecting. It's providing information to taxpayers so that they can do what they need to do to comply with the laws, the tax laws of the state of Minnesota. So it's, if we don't provide the information that they need to voluntarily pay their taxes, that creates a problem. So we're very, very cognizant of the fact that we need to provide taxpayers good information and in a timely way. We provide interpretations of law. We advise taxpayers of their obligations and rights. In terms of service, we provide information that they need to meet their obligations. We process returns, we process payments, millions of dollars of those. We issue refunds, we manage taxpayer accounts. So, sort of a typical financial functions of any large organization. We audit to resolve discrepancies and to discourage tax evasion. And we identify levels and patterns of noncompliance. So we try to analyze why things aren't, you know, if there's a compliance issue, we try to look into it and resolve the issue and understand the causes. And we recommend improvements to the tax system. And as members of the legislature, you know that from time to time we bring to the committee's recommendations for improvements in the tax system. They're either coming from the governor or from the Department of Revenue. So that compliance cycle is a good way to look at the things that we do. We inform, we serve, we process, we audit, we enforce, and we recommend. And it's sort of the circle of life for the Department of Revenue, if you will. The next page, you'll see we have we put some data together on our clients. We serve 3.7 million individual income tax payers. We have 165,000 withholding taxpayers, property tax refund claimants, 786,000. I'll skip over some of the smaller numbers. 284,000 businesses that collect and remit sales taxes. 204,000 corporations, S corporations, partnerships that pay the corporate franchise tax and income taxes. 48,000 fiduciary income taxpayers. Annually, we provide forms and instructions to over 4 million taxpayers and process over 9.2 million filing and payment transactions. We answer 678,000 phone calls on an annual basis. We conduct 142,000 audits and assess approximately $642 million. We collect a similar amount of $625 million through our compliance efforts. And we respond to a fair number of emails, as you can imagine, from taxpayers.
Commissioner, before you move on, what's the latest report on property tax refund claimants? Are we still making progress there on getting more people to claim their refund? We still have a lot of citizens who don't file for it, even though they're eligible. What kind of progress are we making?
Mr. Chair, I didn't look at any data on that before I came over, but I know that historically and currently we go through extensive communications effort to reach taxpayers who we think may not be aware of the property tax refund. It's a critically important program, as you well know, and we go to great efforts to have, you know, make sure that taxpayers understand that that's out there for them. And we get a significant number of calls when it's about time for that refund. We get a significant uptick in the phone calls that we receive. So we staff up for it. I can perhaps get you some data in terms of, you know, how that's been playing out.
Commissioner, I appreciate that the progress that's being made on that front.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
On the next slide, you'll see two columns. Over time, the Department of Revenue has sort of become bifurcated in the sense that because of historical compliance initiatives that have been promulgated either by the governor or by the legislature, we have engaged in compliance initiatives. And I know, Mr. Chair, members, you want to hear about that today. over time, because of the emphasis on direct compliance activities, the department has been bifurcated in basically two aspects. One is what we call direct compliance activity, and these are the collection operation, the various tax divisions, corporate tax, criminal investigations, income tax, petroleum, property, sales and use tax, special taxes, and withholding taxes. So that's the direct compliance. These are frontline collectors and auditors. And we've been investing a lot of money in that through these compliance initiatives. And I'll have a chart later about that. The other part of the department is compliance support. So you have behind those people who are on the front lines, you have a number of employees who are providing the backroom functions, the legal department, the commissioner's office, the communications department, financial management, information systems, tax operations, and tax research. I know you all benefit from the revenue estimates that we send up to you from our research department. And those are the kinds of things that we classify as support functions for the Department of Revenue. But the sort of on-the-line direct compliance and collection and auditing is a significant part of what we're doing now. If you look at the pie charts at the bottom of that page, it's very significant to note that at one time in our history, and we went back to the year 2000, or the 2000-2001 biennium, 52% of the department's resources were in a support function. And now if you look over to the current biennium, or the projected 12-13 biennium, we expect the support function to be 33% of the department's functions. So it shows you the dramatic shift in the mix of where we put our resources between direct compliance activity and compliance support. And so there we have to be careful about the balance between those two large areas of the department. And right now, as you see, it's about a one-third support and two-thirds direct compliance. The next chart sort of goes along with the one we just looked at. It shows our staffing. We have 1,429 employees. But the important thing, if you look carefully at the light green versus the dark green bars, you'll see that the compliance initiatives have accounted. We started those in 2002. And you'll see there, you can see the increase in compliance positions as a result of those compliance initiatives, starting at about 612 positions up to 1,070. And the flip side of that is the compliance support functions, which have consistently declined over that same period of time. So there was that tension between those two areas of the department.
Commissioner, Representative Kahn has a question.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, each time in the budget in this division, we've had some kinds of figures presented about the number of people put into the amount of the budget that goes into compliance and what the return on that budget has been. How have those figures been tracking?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, we have a couple slides coming up on that.
Oh, okay,
that
sorry.
Goes to right to your point of the rate of return on the investment. So we'll be able to answer that very shortly here. The next slide is our budget numbers, our base budget numbers. And you'll see that the 12-13 base is $273,266,000. And there's a breakdown there by fund, and of course, for us, most of it is general fund. We don't have a lot of other funds. Over the years, the department has faced various challenges, and one of them historically has been to get the resources we need to provide good service to the taxpayers. And basically, that translates into technology. And we have, over the years, because of lack of resources historically, we have cobbled together various numbers of sort of ad hoc systems to get a particular job done. And I wish I had the slide here that shows you, we kind of color-coded different systems that we had in the old days. We call them the legacy systems. It's quite a pattern of different colors, each color signifying a different system. when we had all those systems, if a taxpayer had a question, we would have to go in and out of different systems to try to get an answer to the taxpayer's question. It could be a question about their account or the status of their refund or whatever. And it was very tedious to go in and out. And we decided a number of years ago that we needed to try to have a more holistic, integrated processing system that would help us provide better service to taxpayers. And we were fortunate to get funding for that kind of a system recently. I think the funding started in the '07 legislature, and it was roughly a $29 million system. It is fully funded, and it is. We are now beginning discussions on decommissioning the legacy systems that we've had for many years. When when we're fully transitioned to the new, what we call integrated tax system, we will be able to do things that we've never been able to do in the department. We'll be able to track taxpayer accounts. We'll be able to provide service. We will be able, ultimately, to allow taxpayers to adjust their own accounts by not having to even call in. They can simply do it on their computer. So that's where we're headed, and it's going to provide a great increase in taxpayer service. So the challenges for right now are to complete that integrated system. We're nearly there. We're in our fourth rollout. There's some slides coming up on that. Our challenge is to complete the new integrated system, get it fully installed, while still operating with the old legacy systems, because you can't simply disconnect. Sort of have to transition piece by piece. And that's going relatively well. Another challenge for us is the loss of institutional knowledge, but any agency that comes to you will tell you the same story. We have a lot of senior people in government who are knowledge experts, and we worry about them retiring. So that's going to be a challenge for us to identify key people and have a transition plan, sort of a succession plan ready for them when they walk out the door with a lot of knowledge and information that others don't have. I mentioned the growing stress on the agency in terms of compliance support. I gave you the figures. I don't know that I need to add any more to that. That is something we are constantly watching. Another challenge and blessing is the growing diversity of the workforce. We have greater numbers of people who are non-English speaking employees and taxpayers. And our challenge is to find ways to translate our forms and instructions into multiple languages. And we have some help from OAT through a language line. So if a taxpayer comes to the department, we have a problem communicating, we can transfer them over to the language line, and they can do their business in their native language. And so that's been helpful. But it continues to be a challenge with the uptick in diversity of languages. Recently, we had a mandate from the Minnesota Management and Budget to train employees on the Financial Code of Conduct. We trained 1,173 employees. That is no longer a challenge. We've done it, and we now have to monitor the results of that. And as indicated earlier, we are training and housing growing numbers of auditors and collectors. By and large, the department has shifted to a relatively more aggressive stance on auditing and collecting as a result of compliance initiatives. We have had a series of those, and I will soon review that chart with you. Other department challenges, we've had seven. We have had seven distinct and successful compliance initiatives beginning in 2002, but there is a downside to compliance initiatives. As we get relatively more aggressive in our compliance activities, we run the risk of pitting revenue goals against customer service. You have to sort of find a balance between the soft touch and the customer service and the responsiveness to taxpayers against the all-important challenge of meeting the revenue goals that are provided to us by the legislature. And I think we've been doing a good job with that over the years. I also am concerned about the impact on the culture of the department. To the extent that we have more and more compliance initiatives, there tends to become a competitive spirit within the department among auditors and among collectors. It hasn't really shown itself in a big way, but I worry about the extent to which the culture of the department changes a little bit when you get across a certain threshold of aggressiveness.
Commissioner Representative Simon has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, thanks for coming before the committee today. I just, in connection with what you're talking about now, the compliance initiatives, I wanted to go back for a second to the chart depicting the number of employees a few pages back and the division, the bar chart. Obviously, as you've already said, the numbers, I mean, they speak for themselves. The compliance folks now greatly outnumber the support folks. As I see the growth, though, if I'm doing my math right, you've basically only added in 14 years an average of under 10 employees a year. I mean, it went from, my math is 1295 in 1996, if you add up the two columns, to 1429 in 2010. Do the math, that's less than 10 a year. Is it fair to say that without the compliance initiatives, I don't know whether you can even speculate, but without the compliance initiatives, that the overall number might have actually stayed the same or actually gone down?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe that would be an accurate assessment, that it was the compliance initiatives that account for the growth in hiring in the Department of Revenue. And as you know, we've had some cuts over the years, so we've had to manage those now.
Representative,
you're right. I would agree with that.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, when you have these compliance initiatives, when the legislature and the governor tell you that we want you to go ahead and do those, what particular positions does that mean you have to staff up in? I assume it's the more auditors. It's more, who is it that's getting hired and who is it that's not?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the short answer is it's primarily auditors and collectors. Auditors tend to be, and Terry Steinblatt, our Assistant Commissioner for Income Tax, is here, and she can check me on this, but the auditors tend to be a little higher trained, the collectors a little less so. They all get training, but they have different focuses. But that would be, we generally don't use, and we're usually prohibited from using initiative funds for non-compliance activity.
Representative Erdo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Salamone, and back to your the slide on department challenges continue, the one that we're presently on. Just jumping, I guess, to the last point, taxpayers have complained about increased frequency of audits. I'm just wondering, how commonplace is it for someone to be audited more than once?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the answer is that I lost my train of thought here. Hang on a second. It would be unusual to have frequent audits close together. I can't sit here and say that if you're audited today, you won't be audited for 5 years. And we have our programs of compliance initiative. If we find that a taxpayer is non-compliant and it happens to be that they were recently audited, we might take that into account and maybe provide a little more time, but generally, I think we're relatively blind to how frequent we're auditing the same taxpayer, and that's maybe something we need to take a look at and make sure that if we're doing that, there's a good reason for it and not just a happenstance.
Okay. You may proceed.
If you'll go to the slide called Integrated Tax System, this is a report on our progress. I described this briefly moments ago. We are very delighted to have to be nearly completed in the installation of this new integrated tax system. There are various names for the project. The actual project was called OneSource. That was the way we branded it internally in the department. The company we contracted with is called Fast Enterprises. The uniqueness of this company is that all the principals of the company are former state tax revenue officials who have done career changes and gone into the business of selling software to departments of revenue. So we get the advantage of their expertise. This project was, as I said, funded in the 07 and 09 legislature. It was organized in four distinct rollouts based on different tax types. And you can imagine we probably wouldn't start with the individual income tax. We started with the smaller taxes that were less likely to be a problem. But by rollout, you can see that in the initial rollout, we did the sales tax, the Minnesota Care, petroleum, insurance, and mortgage registry and deed. In the second rollout, we took on some of the larger taxes, the corporate income tax, the withholding tax, and so on. So there are four rollouts, and as I said earlier, we are nearing the end of the fourth rollout, and we will soon be in the decommission mode relative to those legacy systems that we've had for many years. Then on the next slide, sorry.
Representative Murphy has a question.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I don't understand what you mean by rollout.
These are phases of the installation of this new integrated tax system. So they're simply taking this large project and breaking it into four distinct pieces. And we called each one a rollout. Rollout one was a collection of taxes that we were going to convert from the old legacy system to the new integrated tax system that we purchased with the help of the legislature. So the rollouts are simply collections of different tax types that we were phasing through, and there were four of them. And the most important one, from my perspective, was implementing the new system for the individual income tax, because there were so many taxpayers involved there. So that has gone fine. We're relatively comfortable where we're at.
So it changes the manner of collecting or the manner of reporting?
Commissioner?
I think there are implications for both. It's a whole new way of operating. Our procedures are different. And this new, and I should say this is a commercial off-the-shelf package, much like you would buy if you bought Windows or something. It's not custom-built, which is a really good thing for us, because as the vendor creates a upgrade to the software, we get it automatically as part of our contract with them. So we don't have to repurchase constantly. We don't have to purchase consulting services. So the implementation is simply taking this out-of-the-box system and installing it in the revenue department. And we were doing it in four distinct phases for each different collection of taxes, if you will. And it's been a great project. We can't say enough good things about this company. Their track record for on time, on budget is just stellar. I mean, it's just a wonderful company, and they can't keep up with the business they have. They've done many states already and a few small jurisdictions.
So, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, would one of the effects of this be why my city treasurer is telling me that we're not getting, the city isn't receiving as much sales tax revenue that they were receiving before?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, this should not affect what a city would receive in terms of their local sales tax. We may have more efficiencies in getting those data identified, and maybe there would be some positive effects on the timing, getting payments out a little faster. It certainly shouldn't provide any negative effect on the processing of tax returns and our relationship with local communities. Mr. Chair, I will proceed to the compliance initiatives if that suits the committee.
Proceed.
On the next slide here, there's our complete history of compliance initiatives from the first initiative, which came to us in 2002. We were appropriated back then $10.3 million of expenditures for an expected return of $60.1 million. the actual return on that first initial investment of compliance activity was a rate of return of 10 to 1. 10 to 1 is a wonderful rate of return, and most of us would be happy to engage in an investment opportunity with that sort of rate of return. But if you look at the column on the far right of that chart, you will see that the rate of return on successive compliance initiatives has dropped steadily from 10.1, as you'll see, to 7.5 to 1, to 6.4, to 6.1. And we are now settling in at what seems to be perhaps a longer-term ratio of 4 to 1. And so there has been diminishing returns, and usually you should expect that when you're dealing with these kinds of things. So we shouldn't be surprised about that. The successive compliance initiatives are shown individually in terms of the appropriation we received, the target that was given to us, and the amount of money that was actually raised. I hope that's pretty clear there. Let me focus on the initiative that we are currently engaged in, which was given to us in the what session was that? 2009 initiative. We were given $10.4 million to raise $41.5, and we are basically on target to raise that number. We're about 71% into the biennium, and we've already raised 39.5 of the 41.5. So we're feeling good about where we're at in terms of being able to meet the target that the legislature assigned to us. Perhaps there are questions on that?
Yes, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Salamone. So just to be clear on how we're reading this chart, are each one of these lines the total appropriation for tax compliance in that biennium, or are they in some fashion additive? In other words, there was $10.3 million appropriated in 2002 and 3, and then on top of that there was another 12.8 in 2004 and 5. How are we to read this? Are these cumulative, or is this just the total appropriation in that biennium?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, it is, in a sense, cumulative. When we get a compliance initiative, we do the initiative, and then those funds become part of our base budget, and continue on. And so we are in the second year by
part of the base.
Maybe you
answer.
Yeah, clarify that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Representative, how it works is you get a
Would you identify yourself for the tape?
Yes. My name is Dan Ostick. I'm the Financial Management Director at the Department of Revenue. Usually how it works is we get an appropriation for the biennium. The second year of that appropriation becomes a part of the base for the next biennium. Okay. So it's only the second year that stays the same.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, so to be clear then, the return on investor, the actual revenues, are those also cumulative? In other words, are we reaping, I'm making up a number, it looks like $400 million in total in compliance initiatives then, as we look at the additive return on that now base budget expenditure?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, again, in the second year, that becomes a part of the base revenues that we bring in. I could get you numbers for that, but it's only that piece that flatlines out for the future years.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then the way to understand this is to say this is the incremental return on investment for the next new dollar of added compliance effort. And so we need to think about that, not only that 4-to-1 ratio return on investment starting to diminish, but also the reverse curve would be taxpayer anxiety and the pain felt by small businesses and large from the compliance activity. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that is.
And then, Mr. Chair, can I follow up with just one last question about the integrated tax system? This is kind of a layperson's understanding, but my sense is that as you're building this integrated tax system within the Department of Revenue, that it's largely focused on the processing of the returns. I assume it probably has some support of the process of compliance audits. Does it increase the intelligence and the targeting of the audits so that you're actually going after people who are most likely to be out of compliance? And then maybe part B of that same question is, are you actually, is this integrated system integrated outside the four walls of revenue so that you've got kind of data anomalies between a person's, you know, record somewhere else and what you see in the Department of Revenue to even focus you even better on people who are you know, not complying in an even broader sense with the law? How's this integrated tax system supporting compliance?
Mr. Commissioner? We're getting a payoff in regards to our ability to do a better job outside of the department as well as just inside. This is not just something that we benefit from as an agency. It affects the taxpayers and the quality of service that we can provide to them. We are very interested in, and we have started doing work in data warehousing and trying to mine the data that we know and that we have about taxpayers so that we can put the steel on the target and not waste resources on going down blind alleys and so on. And that's something we initiated a year or so ago, and I know Greg is here. He just magically shows up, and he can tell us more about that.
My name is Greg Chita. I'm with the Department of Revenue. I'm out of the CIO office. One of the areas that I help lead is the data warehouse group. As part of the integrated tax project, we have transitioned what was our data warehouse into the integrated tax project. And it has a number of pieces of functionality that we're still just learning about because this is relatively new for us. One of the things they have is something called the Discovery Program, and it's an application which gets into some of the more data modeling and using the data that we have right now. Our warehouse has innumerable sources, not just inside the Department of Revenue, but outside with other agencies, the federal tapes, and I don't want to get into too much because that stuff kind of like to play a little close to the vest. But so yes, we are starting to do those things. We have also, previous to the start of the integrated tax project, when we kind of put it on hold, we have worked with the University of Minnesota, working with some of the students and the professor over there in data mining and predictive modeling and using the advanced analytics pieces. It is something that kind of we put on hold as we did this because we wanted to understand the product and the rest. But to your point, it is something that we see a great future in. It is the use of data and the tools and techniques that are out there nowadays to enhance this, both inside the integrated tax, but any other thing that we can come up with.
Before we leave this compliance initiative chart here, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying about this. The appropriation for the individual biennium, is that an appropriation on top of the previous biennium's base budget?
Mr. Chair, the second year of the appropriation, let me give you an example. Let's take fiscal year 2004 and 5. The first year, and I'm just going to use an example, these aren't true, but let's say the first year is an appropriation of $5 million. And the second year is 7.3. Okay, that second year becomes the base of the next biennium on top of our base budget. Does that make sense?
Okay, I see what you're saying now. I'm wondering if it would be better to have a column that shows what you added to the base to achieve the result.
We can do that, Mr. Chair.
Because that... This I think gets confusing the way this is presented. And the other thing too to point out that the revenues that we get from the initiative in any biennium may or may not be realized again in the following biennium. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, usually the second year of the biennium gets taken for the base, and it is on top, and we add that to the base revenues that the Department of Revenue collects. So it is on top of the revenues that we do collect. So we keep a baseline for that, and we keep an initiative. We could report on that as well. But we have base revenues that the department collects, and we have initiative revenues that the department collects for the initiatives. We keep them separate.
Okay. Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome. Good to see you again, Commissioner Salamone. I have to tell you, this is a topic that has come up frequently when I speak to business leaders in my area. To hear them, you would think this is almost like the Inquisition. Let me just start with a very simple question. Have you tracked the number of complaints that you've gotten from enhanced auditing, and what's that trend been like?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't track it in the sense that I think you're asking about in terms of numbers of complaints, types of complaints.
Yeah.
It's easy to count complaints, but it's sort of more difficult to get behind the complaints and figure out what it is exactly that happened and why and so on.
Yeah.
We probably need to do more of that, and it's something we need to be talking about.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you. Commissioner, you got a nice card. By the way, you gladdened my economist heart by mentioning diminishing returns. It always will make me smile. But one of the things that, that in this return on investment piece that you have, costs are always costs to somebody, and the costs that you're talking about here are the expenditures made by the state in enforcement. Has there been any attempt by the department to measure the cost of increased auditing to Minnesota households and businesses?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure when you talk about the cost to households and businesses, are you talking about sort of the...
If I may, I can expand on that. Let me see if I can explain this. When I talk to business leaders and households that have been visited, and this is in particular to the sales tax and sales and use tax. This is not to any of the other audits. Let's just focus on that. The amount of time they spend in preparing additional documents, bringing them to you, the space that they surrender, and engaging typically the manager's, the owner's time in addressing the questions of the auditor. The whole process of dealing with an audit tends to be something they focus on is diverting them from the activities of creating jobs and wealth in the economy that they typically do. Has there been an attempt to measure in some way those costs in terms of getting at this question of these diminishing returns and figuring out where maybe we need to look at whether or not we've gone a bit too far?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a perfectly legitimate point to bring up and something we need to put more horsepower in. There is a cost. There's sort of a fiscal drag, if you will, as we try to pursue more and more compliance initiatives. We're becoming, in a sense, perhaps, and I don't know to what extent, but it's definitely more of an encroachment. And there are costs. The taxpayers have to spend a lot of time providing source documents, and as you said, they have to, in many cases, if it's a corporate audit, they may have to provide space for numerous auditors. So there's definitely cost. How do we quantify that as a challenge?
Sure.
But it ought to be recognized in one way or another, whether we can quantify it or not. Yeah. It's there, and we need to think about how to minimize that particular component of it.
Sure. Two quick follow-ups, if I could, Mr. Chairman. Thanks.
Mr. Banyan?
You'll have people who you found in non-compliance, and after audit, you bring them into compliance. There's probably some rate of recidivism where they fall back out of compliance. Do you have any idea what that is?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think we can provide data on that. I'm not aware of any data that we have, and perhaps following up in that way might in some way be more of a problem in the sense that we're still there and we're still, you know, sort of dealing with the taxpayer, but... again, it would be worth spending some resources in trying to do that.
And I promise the last one. I don't want to monopolize the committee's time, but I do hear reference from some people who have had to experience this, particularly small business people who reported penalties for noncompliance, and I heard a number of three times. I'm not sure I fully understand what those penalties are. Are there penalties for noncompliance, and how much are charged to that? or is that just a business person who doesn't understand the lien or liability that's been placed on them?
I think we have someone else to address that question. Or Commissioner, did
movable
you want
feast, Mr. Chair.
I appreciate a team effort.
I thought you would enjoy hearing Terry Steinblatt, our Assistant Commissioner for Income Taxes, who spends a lot of time and is a former collection director. We'll have a perspective on that.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Terry Steinblatt, and as Commissioner said, I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes. And just to touch on a couple things, in relation to recidivism, we are starting to track that. The new integrated system does allow us to do that, so that is something that as we're transitioning into the integrated system, we are beginning to track. In relation to penalties, there are a variety of different penalties that can apply for noncompliance. It depends upon the situation that may be occurring. That's another thing that we are starting to track as well. As a result of our new integrated system, we are able to track penalties that are assessed. Our goal is to have those penalties diminish, because if we get people into compliance, we won't have to assess those penalties. So in an ideal world, we won't see any penalties that are collected, but there are some. If there's repeated failure to not file or remit payments, 25% repeat penalty. There's a variety of different penalties that may apply.
Just as a quick follow-up, in terms of this, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In terms of these revenues, can you split this between actual uncollected tax and penalties? Could we get a number on that?
Yes.
Thank you.
The answer was yes.
Yes, and I hope we'll get it. Thank you very much.
You will. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, a basic, simple question, hopefully. First of all, what is the percentage of Minnesotans that are in compliance? And secondly, when you're looking at compliance initiatives, do you break that out between individuals and businesses or corporations, and how does that look? And when we're recapturing revenue, how does that look in those categories, if you understand the question?
Yes. Commissioner?
Okay. Chair, Representative, your question takes us to the last slide in my presentation, where we show the compliance revenue as a percent of total tax revenue. By and large, 90 to 95% of our taxpayers are compliant, and we spend a lot of money and time on the other 6% or 4%. And that's what this chart shows. But we do a lot of work in getting taxpayers compliant, but fortunately, there is a very large percentage who do the right thing. They know we've given them enough information. They're able to calculate their tax correctly. And we would really be in trouble if we didn't have that high voluntary compliance component, and it's sort of a Minnesota thing, I'd like to think.
Mm-hmm.
We feel fortunate to have that degree of voluntary compliance. There were other pieces to your question, maybe.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Gauthier,
when we're recapturing revenue through the compliance effort, is that more through individuals or is it corporate or what does that look like?
We're able to,
Commissioner.
We do track the compliance. Corporate versus individual, so we can slice and dice our compliance numbers in various ways. Perhaps we could provide some data for you on that.
That would be nice. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to point out to committee members one of the points that was made about, I guess, the people involved in the developing the integrated tax system, and so were largely former state employees. And I would like to point out a role of the state in training people at low salaries who then lower salaries who then can go out and work in the private sector at significantly higher salaries, with the state absorbing the training costs for those people. I'd also I guess this kind of was answered. I was going to ask Representative Bennion's question in a more positive way, which is how many people, once they've been audited into compliance, then stay in compliance, you know, and in terms following that. Once you've pointed out to someone what they were doing wrong, is there any problem with them not staying in compliance in the future? And do they know they're very likely to be looked at again?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that is something that we will be able to track going forward. We do see a mixture of people that do remain in compliance and some that fall out of compliance. And we try to do lots of educational pieces. At the end of an audit, we sit down with them and explain the audit and talk about the educational and how to keep them into compliance. We've also met with a variety of public groups, and one of the things that they suggested is for new businesses that are starting to have some type of educational program for them on what's expected. So that is something that we're also working on to develop as well to help in that area.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Kahn.
I can't quite remember this. So didn't we use some kind of interesting type of financing for the integrated tax system, or was that something else that we used it for? What did we? Someone's nodding.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, my recollection is we used sort of a leasing arrangement. We issued certificates of participation as opposed to bonds, and given the atmosphere and the situation of that particular session, the 07-09 mm-hmm. period, had we not done that, we probably would not have had an integrated tax system. So we were grateful for the creative way that was done.
And Mr. Chairman, it wasn't just, isn't it a kind of a lease purchase or something? So we do end up owning it?
Yes. Correct.
Okay.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, I'm just curious if you have if you know what percentage of businesses that pay sales tax were actually subject to a sales tax and use audit, or use tax audit.
I could get that information, but yeah. I wouldn't have it here.
Okay, and then follow up if I may.
Go ahead.
We've seen you did well on 218% of your target for compliance and increased collections. I've heard from a number of small business owners who have had people camp out for a couple of weeks and they end up getting, $1,000. Now, so you hear all of those sorts of stories, and that's not the whole picture. But I know I've been told twice by business owners saying, well, geez, the guy collected about, $12 an hour from my company for sitting here for 12 weeks. Do you have a number that shows how much taxes are collected and penalties and interest per hour or per man hour for your compliance team? I'm just curious about that number.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we could certainly make that calculation. We know how much we collect from our various processes, and we could certainly do the math. The thing I'm more concerned with, and we hear the same things some of you are hearing about our aggressiveness and the attitude of the taxpayer. I worry when I talked about the downside of compliance initiatives, that we have to worry about the tone that we set. We are hiring a lot of new people. Every time we get an initiative, we get a batch of new young people, and they need to be trained. And it's not just training the tools of doing auditing and collecting and so on. It's the bedside manner. How you greet a taxpayer when you walk in the door, and just the soft skills of compliance. We need to spend more money and effort in that. And some people don't respond well to that kind of training, and others would. And so it's a challenge for us. I understand what you're saying.
Thank you,
Representative Benson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner and your staff, I want to thank you for being here, and you're an unsung hero to all of us. This is a tough job. I don't think we fully grasp how difficult it must be for you at times to balance those things. But in the explanation of the chart regarding your return on investment, I have some questions. I did a little bit different calculation. I saw from 2002 until 2010, you actually had an increase of total staff of about 29%. And I'm looking at the other graph a little bit differently, or the statistics that you provide on the the return on investment after you told me, or told the committee, of course, that as far as the base budget hours or the money that are used in compliance, it's the second year. But then you also intimated, I believe, that only a part of that revenue becomes base revenue as far as collection. So I don't know that the statistics that you provided today tell us the whole story. That's a one-time snapshot at your return on investment. But what I don't have yet is a sense of, so let's say three-quarters of that amount is really collected in the first year, because that's the impact of that initiative. Okay, so the second year's collections then go into the base revenue, as would the base expenditures, or the expenditures for the second year go in that base. So I don't have a real sense of that transition from the first biennium that you put forth the initiative to the ongoing, then, you know, the impact of those. It may fall significantly below the 4-to-1 of the last couple of years. It may be 1-to-1.5. And I can't tell from this. I don't expect you to have those answers today, but I would certainly like to receive those, please.
Commissioner?
Chair, we'd be happy to try to provide the data that you're talking about.
Okay. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I appreciate Representative Banyan's question about the extent to which taxpayers have to deal with collectors and others coming to their places of businesses. In particular, we don't want people harassing business owners or officers or others. I think that's important. But one other perspective, it seems to me, is that it isn't necessarily just untamed revenue agents combing the state for revenue. Sometimes, in my experience, it's businesses or individuals seeking special tax treatment that they perhaps aren't entitled to. So it starts with them seeking something that maybe the Department of Revenue believes is not theirs. And just, I mean, full disclosure, for 3 years I was in the tax litigation division of the AG's office, so I worked in this area. And, you know, you might have a situation, I remember a case that I worked on, where a business claimed a certain exemption for the purchase of capital equipment. It was only available to those who were manufacturers. This was a cell phone company. They claimed that they were manufacturing the human voice, the facsimile of the human voice. They were actually manufacturers, and they were entitled to this tax break to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, because they were indeed a manufacturer. Because when you speak into a phone, what they were doing was manufacturing the actual human voice into something that sounded like the human voice. Now, it is not unreasonable for the Department of Revenue to say, wait a minute, you're claiming tens of millions of dollars of our what is taxpayer money. We're going to challenge that. You are not a manufacturer. You are a cell phone company. You do something else. So I just want to give another perspective, that sometimes this is touched off not by roving revenue agents looking to catch people in mistakes, but it's touched off by businesses or individuals who say, I get something. I get a deduction. I get an exclusion. I fit into this category. And the department says, actually, we see it a different way. So I think it's important to get that perspective out there. The other question I wanted to ask, an uncomfortable one maybe, is I know recently you had a bad headline about an employee in the Department of Revenue who has allegedly embezzled quite a bit of money. And I know we're going to hear this morning from Mr. Nobles, our legislative auditor, who's been looking into that. I'm wondering if you could give us some comfort today about the internal controls with respect to that incident and like incidents, and also if you could touch on another issue. I haven't seen headlines about it recently, but you might want to comment on it. What about just the privacy of our tax returns? I remember when I was working with the department, that was a big deal, but that was in the mid to late 90s, and now with the proliferation of technology, I'm just wondering if you can comment. When we all as individuals or businesses submit tax information, can you give us some comfort about the privacy of that, that that's not going to get out, that only a few hands can touch that information?
Commissioner?
Dear Representative, thank you for the question. It's an important question. First, to the question of the refund fraud, it was fraud. It was unfortunate. We are doubling back and taking a look at our procedures. We're going to get more reporting than we've ever gotten from our systems, and our new system is going to be very helpful in that regard. But the bottom line is, it, you'll never have 100% confidence that that these things can't happen. It's just you can throw a lot of resources at it, and we certainly need to put more there. But it was fraud, and when that came to light, we immediately shared with the entire agency. All 1,400 or 1,200 employees came to the various rooms, and we had satellite television broadcasting of the description of what happened and our outrage at that event. And obviously, we expect that those people will wind up doing some time. So it was an unfortunate thing. We're doing everything we can to sort of tighten things up. We're going to invest more resources into our internal audit division, which has been relatively small. It needs a significant increase in resources to do the things that we think we need to do. With regard to privacy, that goes right to the core of what we are all about at Revenue. There, in the code of conduct for every employee, there is a strong statement about the importance of protecting taxpayer data. We have training programs on that. We just did some training a couple of days ago for new employees. So we take that very seriously. We have a disclosure officer who is very aggressive, and I can assure you that everything that we can possibly do to make sure that taxpayer records do not fall into the wrong hands or are seen by the wrong people, we're going to make sure that that doesn't happen. I know a number of years ago there was one of our satellite offices lost the tape. Some of you might remember this, and I was commissioner at that time. And that was kind of a traumatic experience for the agency. It ultimately was not lost. It turned out the post office lost the tape. It wasn't the fault of our employees. But that was a very traumatic experience for us, and we learned lessons from that. But you're dead on in terms of the importance. If we lose the taxpayers' confidence that we're not able to protect their data, we lose essentially everything in terms of our ability to administer the tax system.
Members, we're going to have to shift gears here by 9:30, so we still have some more folks on the list here. I just wanted to give everyone a heads up. We need to get to Mr. Noble's by 9:30. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Salamone, I'm always interested in this slide with your FTE count, 1996 through 2010. First an observation, which is that your support staff numbers have been steadily declining, while your compliance staff numbers obviously have been going up. I think the decline in your support staff numbers is similar to what other similar state agencies have seen during that same time period, the Minnesota Management and Budget, for example. And one of the things that seems to happen, and this committee it's reflected in this committee's budget target, but the financial management administrative functions of state agencies receive larger budget hits than other parts of state government do, in large part because there's no built-in constituency. There's no public service that you're providing by having your administrative and managerial functions well-staffed. And I wonder if you could, if you would be able to draw any conclusions about the reductions in management staff and this incident that occurred at your agency, and a comparison with other similarly large agencies that have had significant financial management scandals in the last 2 to 3 years, and what it is that we can do. I don't see your managerial numbers going up dramatically. What is it that we can do to make sure that as we cut that management staff, we're actually not eliminating checks and balances, financial safeguards, and other important management functions?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I share your interest and concern with that question. We need to be able to have a comfort level on that. Let me ask Terry to respond on this.
Yes. Ms. Steinblatt?
Mr. Chair, members, there's a variety of different things that happened in this particular case, and there's numerous things that we have put in place. The biggest issue behind this refund was that it occurred in our old legacy system that was more than 20 years old, and it was very difficult for managers to review the activity that was occurring in there to make sure that it was appropriate, because they had limited access to that. We had to query. There were a lot of things behind that. So one of the things that we are doing as a result of this, there's several different things that we're implementing, but one of them is to make sure we're providing our management with new training, making sure that we're emphasizing the importance of reviewing work, making sure that we're looking at the supervisor-to-employee ratio and making sure that those ratios are appropriate, that allow them to do the checks and balances that are necessary in order to make sure that this doesn't happen again, in addition to some system changes and some security changes, some policy changes.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess I just would ask whether it's a reasonable takeaway that the traditional management system was much more employee intensive, and your hope is that through technology and a technology investment that you can provide the same level of oversight and controls, but with just fewer people required to do it, and we'll see in the, I guess, the years to come whether that's borne out.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Commissioner,
your hypothesis that the reduction in support might have some connection to these events is perhaps plausible, but I think we'd have to do a little work to sort of find the correlation and sort of get inside the system and figure out. You almost have to look at individual positions and try to make that judgment.
And Mr. Chair, I think perhaps Mr. Nobles may comment on this as well.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. regarding your return on investment here and doing audits on businesses, do you have an idea of how many people you audited and found out that they were already in compliance and that the state actually owed them money rather than them owing us?
Commissioner?
We don't have it, but
Mr. Chair, I'm told we don't have that data with us. We can certainly try to get some information for you on that. It's a good question.
Well, Mr. Chair, I had several businesses that are in my district where they had basically told the auditor that they, after they did a first audit, they came back and said, well, we got to come back and we'll be here for another 2 weeks. And after the second week, after the end of the second week, they found out that the state owed them money. And so I'm just kind of, they were very happy, but they were very happy to be done with them the first time they were there, but they had to come back for another two-week session, which delayed them and caused inconvenience in their situation. So it's interesting to see that as much as the aggressiveness of the Internal the Revenue Services here, that sometimes we it'd be interesting to know how much we end up having to pay as a state back to these people who were in compliance and they were happy the way it was, but... Anyway, just thought I'd like to see that information.
Question noted. Representative Slawik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the members, and then I have a question. As I just find the conversation about compliance interesting, as Representative Simon talked about a different perspective. Recently, I think it was the Speaker himself that introduced a bill about increased compliance. And the story was that in times, tough budget times, compliance becomes even more important, and it's typically, it was framed as a strategy to recoup more money. So that in when we have a $6 billion deficit, we should be looking at increased in compliance, and there was an initiative by the Speaker. And so I wanted to ask the Commissioner about the Speaker's initiative, and if you see other initiatives that might be coming down the pike, is there more compliance we should be doing?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, restate your question while I think.
Well, the Speaker, Kurt Zellers of the House, introduced a compliance initiative, and I'm not exactly sure what it was, except that they said this is a typical thing to during tough fiscal times, but do you see there's even more that can be done in compliance? So,
well, our view, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative, our view would be that there's sort of a well that we continue mining, or a mine that we continue mining to try to get as much money that's owed to the state, paid to the state, and right. That's what we're all about. And to the extent that we can do that with a soft touch and with some, not offending the taxpayer, it's a good thing, and that's sort of what we try to do.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a real quick question, then maybe a comment. So the actual revenues that we're looking at here, is that net revenues of what we actually took in versus what we might have refunded?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the numbers on the chart that we saw were, it shows the amount that we appropriated and the amount that we either are expected to return or have returned on that chart. So it is the net amount.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my assumption, too. And just a quick comment to some of the recent discussion, which I think has created an inference or painted a picture that I'm not sure is entirely accurate. I think there's a number of initiatives that have been proposed in bill form, and I don't know what the speaker may have proposed, but the idea of doing claims audits for Medicare and Medicare, using automated techniques to actually scrub claims, to look at quote-unquote bad debt from the state government perspective, to look at these compliance issues. I think I personally, and probably everyone on this committee, would say, yeah, now's a good time. It's probably always a good time to make sure that we're eliminating fraud and making sure that people are fairly paying. So I don't know that necessarily the broad-based initiative to get at collections at the state is somehow a mistake. I think it's probably a good thing if done prudentially, and we've, I think, identified a couple of places here where we might need to balance the cost and impact on businesses against the return to the state and look at that and weigh all those factors fairly. I also, and we'll wait to hear from Mr. Nobles, but the assumption that somehow the reduction in personnel has led directly to some of these problems, one could argue the reverse, that we're actually doing a much better job of detecting the issues today than we were previously through the automated systems and through better controls that have been implemented. So I just want to make sure we aren't left with the assumption that more people of necessity equals better controls and better auditing, and you wouldn't have these kinds of issues. It could, in fact, be a reverse correlation just by the fact that we're doing a better job. So we'll wait to hear from Mr. Nobles.
Commissioner, I take it that from what you've said that this new integrated system will enable you to better answer many of the questions that were raised here today with hard information than what we've had before. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
You've noted in your handout here that you expect this to be completed by February of 2012, next year. At this point, do you anticipate any major issues or problems that could get in the way of meeting that goal, or are things going along at such a pace that you feel fairly confident that you're going to meet that goal, that objective, so we are going to have better information beyond that date?
Mr. Chair, I'm
Commissioner?
Very confident that we will bring that project in on time, on budget, and don't anticipate any obstacles between now and the 2012, the end of that project. I think it's going to be, obviously we may have a bump or two along the way, but we have a good governance structure for that project, and when we have issues that come up, we resolve them quickly. I just don't see any obstacles to a successful completion of that project.
Representative Kahn, quick question?
Yes. Very quick. This is a little bit of philosophy. I remember a conversation we had a long time ago about progressivity in the tax collection system, which I think you were even working in a Republican administration, had a surprising interest and sympathy for. And one of the things that we talked about is how one of the most progressive things that we have done is the concept of rent credit compared to other kinds of credits? Is that still something you believe in?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, anything we can do to help taxpayers, I guess I believe in, and including helping them with their property tax payments. Minnesota has done a very good job in helping taxpayers in that regard. If you did a comparison, as I did many in my old job at the Taxpayers Association, we're a good state in terms of taking care of low-income taxpayers and helping out, particularly with the property tax.
Commissioner, thank you very much and your staff for being here today. And Commissioner, since two-thirds of your budget is in the compliance area, when you do come back to us for your budget presentation, obviously you can expect our interest in really thoroughly talking about that. And particularly, I want to put you on notice, too, that that I'm concerned about our ability to attract and retain auditors. I mean, so I think you need to be prepared to address that issue, too, as we consider your budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Commissioner and staff. Yeah, members, please hang on to this. Put it in your save file. Since we'll be needing to refer back to this when revenue comes back. Legislative Auditor Nobles, proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor, and I did not bring my team. Unfortunately, you just have to listen to me, and I will try to answer any questions you have. If I can't, I will go back to the team and try to get those for you. Mr. Chairman, you have in your packet, I believe, copies of the slide presentation, and it will obviously be up on the screen. I'm going to move through this rather quickly because I would like to leave a little bit of time for your questions, and particularly to come back to some of the questions that were addressed to the Department of Revenue that also affect the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So thank you very much for this opportunity. I just want to remind you, and particularly some of the newer members, how we came to have an Office of the Legislative Auditor. We were created in 1973 at the recommendation of a group called the Loaned Executive Action Panel. This was one of those efforts that was, I think, very successful. There was a group of corporate executives that were brought into state government. They made a very in-depth examination focused particularly on the financial operations of state government. They made a number of recommendations. One of their recommendations was that the legislature should create an Office of the Legislative Auditor modeled very much after the Government Accountability Office at the national level. The basic principle that LEAP, the Loaned Executive Action Panel, was articulating was that the post-audit and oversight function is inherently a legislative branch responsibility. And they felt that the legislature should have within the legislative branch an Office of the Legislative Auditor. Now, you're probably wondering, as this question often comes up, what about the state auditor? There was a state auditor. There is a state auditor. LEAP actually recommended that the Office of Treasurer, and we used to have an elected treasurer in the Constitution, LEAP recommended that the Office of the Treasurer and the state auditor be abolished, that this was basically a professional nonpartisan function that should be conducted in that way. The legislature did not initially adopt either of those approaches. The treasurer stayed in the Constitution for a number of years, eventually was removed, as you know, and that function is performed within the Department of Management and Budget. The legislature decided to divide the jurisdiction and responsibility of auditing, post-auditing, between the legislative auditor and the state auditor. Interestingly, the state auditor, prior to the creation of the Office of the Legislative Auditor, was never a post-auditor. The state auditor was, prior to the creation of the Office of the Legislative Auditor, an internal controller within state government, co-signed the warrants of the state. The actual post-audit function, prior to 1973, was under the jurisdiction of an appointee of the governor, the public examiner. and the public examiner had an office that did all post-auditing, state and local. So that's a little bit of the history lesson. Let me move on. We have, I think, a very clear, very well-focused mission, which we understand every day very clearly, and it drives what we do. We are here to strengthen accountability and legislative oversight. We very much see ourselves as your agents, digging deep within departments and agencies and programs on your behalf. We would like to, wherever we can, of course, promote strong financial management and cost-effective administration of organizations and programs funded with public money. Those are very big, very important responsibilities that we take seriously. How do we go about trying to promote that mission? Well, it's through the products that we produce. And as you undoubtedly know now, even some of you who are new, we produce a fair number of these products. And they result from different kinds of audits, evaluations, and investigations. We have three basic types of audits that we conduct: compliance and control audits, and I'll talk about those in a little more detail later. We also conduct financial statement audits, and this is something that actually takes a considerable amount of time for the Office of the Legislative Auditor to fulfill this responsibility. It results in an audit opinion, which is probably one of the most important and least read things that we produce. It is difficult, to say the least, to read through an audit opinion. I tried very hard over the years to change the language to make it a little more readable, but we are bound by a number of very legal requirements and generally accepted auditing principle requirements to write an audit opinion the way you see it. But it is an important document. It tells the world that every year when the state of Minnesota produces these financial statements, it tells the world whether or not they have complied with generally accepted accounting principles or GAAP. That is the point of this. I might say that this is becoming more and more important. We just spent a considerable amount of time on a recent bond issue that the state is going to be issuing and had to go back over previous audit opinions that were going to be used as a part of that bond issuance because, as you may well know, the Security and Exchange Commission and other credit rating agencies are looking very closely at the financial soundness of state government and government across the board, but particularly those that are making bond issues based on certain credit ratings, and they are insisting upon a much more full, complete disclosure of pension liabilities. And so, again, this is a somewhat, I think, obscure, shall we say, thing that goes on in state government, but it is a very important tool of accountability. As I think some of you know, you work on basically a cash basis in the budget, and that offers a lot of opportunity to shift payments, shift the recognition of revenue. When you get to GAAP and when you get to these financial statements, you can't do that. And so this, in many people's view, is a more reliable, shall we say, statement of the state's financial operations and condition. And this is what credit rating agencies look at to give the state its credit rating. So it's an important thing that we do. We also audit the financial statements of a number of other organizations over the year. The third kind of audit that we do looks mostly at security. And if we have time for questions, we can certainly come back to this issue in the context of what happened at the Department of Revenue. Over the last couple of decades, the Office of the Legislative Auditor has tried very hard to develop a strong, very specialized group of people within our Financial Audit Division who know how to go into computer systems, information technology systems, which have become increasingly complex, and examine the security within those and give recommendations to agencies to improve that security. Unfortunately, the people that we have developed to do that work are often taken away from us by state agencies and other people. And so we are now in the third attempt to construct a team that is able to do this work. The first team that we built, basically four specialized IT auditors, became the audit team, the security team for OET. Chris Boozy, who many of you know, was at one time the manager of our IT audit function. He now is the state's chief information security officer. And in fact, the person who replaced Chris Boozy was just hired by Minsky to become their chief information security officer. So we lost him, and he took most of the team with him, as Chris took the most of our team when Chris went to OET. So we are now trying to rebuild that group so that we can perform the function of these very specialized and complicated information technology audits.
Auditor, yes. Representative Kahn has a question.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nobles, I recently had a conversation with one of the most renowned CIOs in the country, Stephen Fletcher from the state of Utah. And one of the things he said is that Utah went to a four-day week, I guess throughout the state, and he said that was an incredibly good recruiting tool when he was looking to hire high-tech people in terms of the city. He says, I can't promise you as good a salary as you'll make in the private sector. I mean, here you're now competing with the rest of the public sector too, but I can guarantee you a three-day weekend every week. And he said that was an extremely good recruiting tool for the kinds of people he's trying to hire. Any thoughts about that kind of flexibility? Should we give you that sort of flexibility, or you can compete with these other guys?
Chairman, Representative Kahn, you opened up a door that I probably should not go through because I have strong feelings on this.
On my side or not?
Not necessarily on your side, because my greatest challenge running the office is getting enough hours to get the work done. I don't know if the four-day week included 10-hour days, which we do accommodate for our staff. We also allow a certain amount of telecommuting. But my recommendation, and I don't mean to sound facetious, because indeed we can't compete with private sector salaries, and so we have to offer a number of other incentives. The greatest incentive I can offer is the glory of working at the Office of the Legislative Auditor.
Kind of like the glory of being in the House of Representatives.
Correct. And I do mean that sincerely. I actually have it as a part of my slide if I get to the end. How do we keep people in the office? I give a monthly inspirational speech. That's and it is actually quite good. You should come. But in spite of that, we have had quite a bit of turnover. But to your point, I mean, we do need to find ways to accommodate people. We try to be very family-friendly. But ultimately, when push comes to shove, I need people to show up. It's the only way we get the work done. The only way we get our work done is for people to show up and work. So I wouldn't necessarily join you in cutting back on hours. In fact, and I probably shouldn't say this, but if you want to do anything and everything else you can do to cut back on holidays or leave time and have people be at work more, and I could deliver more to you at the office. Anyway, I better leave that topic alone and stick with my prepared remarks. The other two things that I wanted to mention that we do, and we're going to be releasing another one of these Big Blue reports today. Their evaluations, these are done directly in response to concerns that legislators have. We cover a wide range of topics. We recently released a report, for example, on natural resource land that some of you are aware of. We also did a very comprehensive examination of the Chancellor's Office at Minsky. Today we're going to be releasing a report on medical non-emergency transportation. Later, we're going to be releasing a report on civil commitment of sex offenders, and the list goes on. So we have a fairly small unit within the Office of the Legislative Auditor of basically 12, sometimes 13 people who do these evaluations in response to your requests. I also want to mention that we also do investigations. We have one person who is the director of our investigative unit. We will periodically pull other people into that unit when issues arise that need an investigation. I personally am always on any team that is conducting an investigation And so I'm a part of all of those as well. We receive about 60, 70 allegations of various kinds from all sorts of people, legislators, citizens, people within agencies. We also turn things up in our audits that we think need a more in-depth examination. An investigation really is triggered when we believe there is evidence that a state employee or someone else who has the custody of public money has used it inappropriately. So all of these other kinds of audits and evaluations are mostly looking at systems, structure, process. In those reports, we will not name names. If we conduct an investigation, we will name the individual who we believe was involved either in the misuse of public funds or did not adequately supervise to the extent that they were able to either prevent it or detect it. So that's what, excuse me, that's what is the difference when we get into the investigative mode. We have one principal goal. We have several other ones, but I think the most important one to mention to you is that in every report that we release, any of these financial audit reports, evaluation reports, investigative reports, our goal is quite forward and quite straightforward and simple, and that is to ensure that every report is accurate, objective, timely, and useful. How do we achieve that? Well, first of all, we work consistently and in compliance with generally accepted auditing standards. They're very rigorous. That means that everything that we write, we have to verify the factual basis of it. Everything has to be documented. Every one of these reports will have boxes and boxes of work papers. We increasingly are, of course, making those electronic and not on paper. But generally accepted auditing standards means that our facts are documented in our work papers. It also requires us to go through an extensive amount of internal and external review. We also have some important standards in our office. They sort of grow out of generally accepted auditing standards, but we emphasize them very much in our own OLA standards, and that is independence. Independence is really the cornerstone of audit work, both organizational and personal. We achieve organizational independence by the fact that, first of all, we're in the legislative branch, and our jurisdiction is to audit the executive branch and the judicial branch. We do not audit the legislative branch because we would not be independent to do so. So that's one element of how we achieve in our office organizational independence. Another way is that the legislative auditor is appointed for a six-year term. And so that allows for a degree of independence that in the audit world is considered important. Individual independence is also extremely important, and every person in our office on every assignment has to fill out an independence questionnaire. Anytime anybody in our office, including myself, is assigned to any work, we have to answer a number of questions about our affiliations, our family relationships, our financial interests, and we will not assign anybody to an audit or an investigation or an evaluation where there could potentially be either an actual or the appearance of an independence impairment. We will also, frankly, take people off assignments if an independence impairment occurs during an assignment, which it does. If we have somebody working at an agency and they are approached and offered employment in that agency, that auditor has to be taken off of that assignment. And that has, unfortunately, increasingly occurred. Sort of back to the question of the jurisdictional divide, the state auditor has jurisdiction over local units of government, cities, counties, school districts, townships. The legislative auditor is the auditor of state government. The bulk of what we do is audit in the executive branch, but we also have jurisdiction to audit within the judicial branch, and we do a certain amount of that. Have a document I think that you have in your packet that will show during our round of audits that we intend to do this year, we're going to be looking at one of the judicial districts. We also have jurisdiction to examine, particularly in our financial audit division, any state-funded program. So even though there is this jurisdictional divide between the state auditor and the legislative auditor on financial audits, As you well know, we often go into programs that are administered locally but funded by the state. We have done a lot of evaluations, for example, of various kinds of educational programs. And that is because you have given us in law the jurisdiction to evaluate any state-funded program. Frankly, even programs that are administered by nonprofit organizations. If they're funded by the state, we have jurisdiction to evaluate them. We also have jurisdiction over three metropolitan organizations. Years ago, the legislature simply divided the metropolitan agencies between the state auditor and the legislative auditor. We got the Mosquito Control Commission, the Air Force Commission, and the sports facility. Did I say sports facilities? Sports facilities. Those are the three that we have. We also have jurisdiction to audit and evaluate quasi-governmental organizations. For example, the Minnesota Historical Society is not technically a state agency. It's a nonprofit organization, but receives a lot of state money. We have jurisdiction to audit there. And if that were not enough, we can basically, under the law, trace public money every and anywhere it goes. And as you well know, increasingly, particularly under the Legacy Amendment, a lot of public money is going into private organizations, nonprofit organizations, and you in state law have given us the authority and jurisdiction to trace that money and examine it and require people who receive it to cooperate with us. And this is the sort of the next point. And this is very important. In law, you have given the legislative auditor very strong statutory authority, which requires people in state agencies, in nonprofit organizations, anyone who is the custodian, recipient of public money, they must by law cooperate with the legislative auditor. We also have subpoena power if that's necessary. We very rarely use that, but on occasion, particularly in our investigations, we do issue subpoenas. In addition, the Office of the Legislative Auditor has authority to access all documents and data regardless of its classification if it's involved in the use of public funds. This also becomes extremely important. There was some talk of tax records at the Department of Revenue. We have jurisdiction to go in and look at those records as a part of our examination of what's going on at the Department of Revenue. We also have jurisdiction if we go into the Department of Human Services to see not public data. And I might say, because the question was raised about protecting private data, this is a very, very important aspect of working at the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Because of the authority that we have, and because we do in fact see a lot of not public data, we have a very heavy emphasis in our office on data security. Both in terms of the construction of our data systems and our computer systems, but also in terms of the personal conduct of our auditors. We require anybody who works in our office to be fully aware of their legal obligation, and it is a legal obligation they take on when they come to work for us to protect not public data from any unauthorized exposure. And we emphasize, frankly, that that is one of the violations that would cause an immediate termination of an employee if they violated that principle in any way. So just the final thing, legislative auditor does from time to time, again, more in the context of investigations, take testimony under oath. Our organization is actually pretty simple. We work most directly under the Legislative Audit Commission, which, as you know, I think, is a bipartisan commission with equal representation from the four caucuses of the legislature. It's 12 members. Representative Mike Beard was just recently elected chair of the Legislative Audit Commission for the next two-year cycle. The chairmanship switches back and forth every 2 years between the House and Senate. The Legislative Audit Commission appoints the legislative auditor, and as I mentioned, the legislative auditor is appointed for a six-year term, cannot be removed during that term except for cause. Thankfully, that hasn't happened yet. I hope it never does. I am currently serving my fifth six-year term. Within the office, we have a financial audit division, a program evaluation division, and I'll get to the staffing in just a moment. We also have some support staff as well. So here's the basic staffing arrangement within the office.
Auditor Nobles, when you're talking here about the commission. I think it would be helpful for you, since we have many new members here on this committee, to talk briefly about the process that the commission uses to decide what it is they're directing you to examine, and also any advice that you would have to all of us as legislators as to how we should carefully pick and choose what we ask you to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's an excellent question. Every year, the Legislative Audit Commission asks legislators, and that will start to happen very soon, and they will formally send you a letter, each of you, asking you to suggest anything that you think needs to be evaluated. And again, that's a broad range. It could be an organization, it could be a program, it could be a lot of different things. And we accumulate those. We usually get about 70 or 80 suggestions from legislators. We also accept them, as I said, from citizens, from interest groups, and within state agencies. The governor often asks. Actually, the chancellor of the Minscu system asked for the evaluation that we did at the chancellor's office. So those requests come from many sources. The Legislative Audit Commission sets up a subcommittee every year. Again, it's bipartisan. They have some criteria. They go through an iterative process of considering those 60 or 80 or however many come in. They start to narrow the list down. We start to consider criteria such as, does the state have jurisdiction and control over this enough that an evaluation might result in recommendations that the legislature could actually implement or that the agency could? Is there any indication that there really is a problem here? And there are a variety of other criteria that the Legislative Audit Commission goes through, and we help them in that process. We start doing a fair amount of background work, especially once we get to a group of semi-finalists, as we call them, which are usually about 16 or 18 or so topics. We start to develop background, try to understand better the issues that are involved, what methodology we might use. And then ultimately, after the Legislative Audit Commission asks you again for input, we actually send out a ballot of the semifinalists, and we ask you to check off among these semifinalists which are the most important four or five or whatever number there might be that you think ought to be evaluated. The Legislative Audit Commission takes that into consideration and then ultimately chooses usually six, seven, eight topics. And in terms of care. You know, we want to know what you are worried about, what you're concerned about, and where you think an independent evaluation by an office like ours could be helpful. I mean, one of the things that we do in our process of trying to select topics is determine whether or not we might be uniquely qualified in some way to do it. And it's not because we're smarter than other people. It's not because we know more than other people. But we are going to be able to use the tools and the authority that you've given us. We do actually have some folks in the Program Evaluation Division that are pretty skilled at taking on big, new, complicated topics and digging into them for about 6-7 months and turning around a pretty comprehensive report for you. But we certainly are willing to take anything and would certainly come and talk to you in more detail about what concerns you have and work that through the process. So, Mr. Chairman, I hope that's helpful.
Yes.
This process of topic selection will begin very soon.
Noble, we're about out of time here. If you could wrap up quickly, and we'll have you back on budget issues here again, of course.
We have a staff right now of roughly 60 people. That's a significant loss from earlier, some years ago. We used to be an organization of about 79 or 80 people, but because of budget cuts over the years, we currently are 60, and that's fine. We'll deal with 60. We'd like to keep that fairly stable if we can. It stretches us a lot, but here's the deployment of those resources. Let me just quickly go to what are the challenges, and I'd be happy to come back if you want to talk about these or other things later. But like you've heard from other organizations, one of our biggest challenges is retaining experienced staff. We offer a lot of very well-trained staff to the rest of state government, as I said. So what is my response to that? I literally mean we say to people that what you're doing at the Office of the Legislative Auditor is very important. We have an important mission, and we ask for your commitment to that. But people do leave, unfortunately. Our biggest other challenge is providing adequate audit coverage throughout state government. We have jurisdiction over 180 different organizations. We do the statewide audit. We do a lot of stuff. Deploying the staff that we have is challenging. We do that, we hope, we think, in a very strategic way through asking you what we need to focus on, but also through going through risks assessments to deploy our financial audit resources. So with that, Mr. Chairman, thank you again.
Well, thank you, Auditor Nobles, and we will have you back to talk about your budget here in the not-too-distant future. Members, tomorrow we're hearing from the Secretary of State's office and the Office of Enterprise Technology. And then on Thursday, we're going to finish up the pension discussion, and we have Bill and the workforce report. That's Thursday, yeah. As well as Representative Kahn's bill. Meeting adjourned.